The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'll be reading articles principally from the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. And the Mayo Clinic Health Letter I'm reading has a lead article about thyroid nodules. If your healthcare team finds a lump on your body, it's natural to be nervous or for your mind to jump to fears about cancer. But if the lump is in your thyroid, a thyroid nodule, you can breathe a little easier. While it's estimated that perhaps 50% of older adults have a thyroid nodule, only about 5% of these nodules are cancerous. Still, it's imperative to see your healthcare team for a definitive diagnosis. Thyroid cancers that are caught earlier and have not spread are more likely to be successfully treated. Most people with thyroid cancer do exceedingly well. It typically does not cause life-threatening problems, says Dr. Victor Burnett, an endocrinologist at Mayo Clinic in Florida. But it's important to get individualized care. The thyroid is a small butterfly-shaped gland under the Adam's apple. The thyroid produces hormones that affect crucial body functions, like heart rate, body temperature, and metabolism. Thyroid hormone impacts almost every tissue and organ we have in our body and helps the body to work better, says Dr. Burnett. It's like oil in your car, keeping the machinery running well. However, thyroid nodules usually don't affect production of these hormones. This means symptoms of an overactive or underactive thyroid are not expected, as blood tests of thyroid function will remain in the standard range. And many nodules are too small to be seen or even too small to be felt. Because symptoms are not typical, nodules are often found during a physical exam or imaging test done for another reason. But some nodules do grow large enough to cause swelling at the base of the neck. Larger nodules can be uncomfortable if they press on nearby structures and cause difficulty swallowing or shortness of breath. Some nodules cause a hoarse voice due to the thyroid's proximity to the vocal cord nerves. If a thyroid nodule is rarely a cancer, what is it? There are several different kinds. The first can be thyroid tissue. A nodule may simply be a clump of thyroid tissue, or it could be an overgrowth of healthy thyroid tissue called an adenoma. Sometimes a nodule can become overactive. This is also called autonomous. This means it produces too much of the hormone thyroxine, leading to a condition called hyperthyroidism. This can cause symptoms like an unexpected weight loss, tremor, rapid or irregular heartbeat, and increased sweating. Then there's a thyroid cyst. A pure cyst is a fluid-filled sac in the thyroid. More commonly, when a nodule degenerates, it can turn into a complex cyst that has both solid and fluid parts. Pure cysts are not cancerous. Complex cysts need further assessment. Then there's thyroid enlargement. This can occur for several reasons. Not consuming enough iodine can cause overall enlargement known as goiter, in addition to nodules. Iodine deficiency is uncommon in the United States, as iodine is routinely added to salt and to other foods. Then there's thyroid cancer. Rarely, the nodule may be cancer. Additionally, some cancers can spread to the thyroid, like melanoma and breast cancer. Certain tests can determine whether a thyroid nodule is cancer. An ultrasound can provide information about nodule characteristics, like the size, shape, appearance, borders, structure, and location, as well as the number of nodules. This information can help to guide testing and management. Your healthcare team will likely want to determine if your thyroid is functioning as it should. Your care team may look for an overactive thyroid called hyperthyroidism, or an underactive thyroid called hypothyroidism. Generally, this is done using tests that measure hormones in your blood, such as thyroid-stimulating hormone, TSH. A low TSH level points to hyperthyroidism, meaning your thyroid is producing excess hormone. The good news is this suggests an overactive nodule, which is almost always non-cancerous. The next step may be a thyroid uptake test and scan, which can confirm whether you have an overactive nodule. During this imaging, an isotope of radioactive iodine or technetium is injected into a vein or given orally. Overactive nodules, called hot nodules, show up on the scan because they take up more of the isotope than healthy thyroid tissue does. Nodules that take up less of the isotope, called cold nodules or hypofunctioning nodules, could be cancer, though most are not. Cold nodules may require a biopsy, depending on the characteristics seen on ultrasound. A thyroid uptake test is not indicated if blood tests show that your TSH is within or above the standard range. These results indicate a typically functioning or underactive thyroid, respectively. Results of an ultrasound may help determine whether a biopsy is needed. If an ultrasound shows that a nodule is not likely to be cancer, you may not need a biopsy. Instead, you may need to return for a follow-up ultrasound in the future. Your team will determine how frequently follow-up imaging is needed. Biopsies of the thyroid help determine whether cancer is present. When a biopsy determines the nodule is not cancer, this finding is accurate 95% of the time. Typically, fine needle aspiration, FNA, is used for thyroid biopsies. In fine needle aspiration, a very thin needle is inserted through the skin into the nodule to remove a sample of cells. Usually, ultrasound is used to help direct the needle. The sample then goes to the laboratory to be analyzed. Though the idea of a biopsy may seem frightening, it's usually a simple procedure. It may not require anesthesia and can be done in about 20 to 30 minutes. Sometimes a biopsy is indeterminate. That means it's not clear whether the cells are cancer or not cancer. Generally, if the findings are not clear, another biopsy may be done. In the past, when results were still unclear, typically the treatment was surgery to remove a portion of the thyroid and test it. If the nodule turned out to be cancer, the remaining thyroid lobe would sometimes be removed. Today, an alternative option called molecular testing is available. Molecular testing looks at the genetic material of biopsied cells to evaluate whether cancer is likely to be present. To do this testing, your care team may need to perform another biopsy if some cells from a previous biopsy were not preserved. If you have a non-cancerous nodule that isn't causing any problems, or a very small cancerous nodule with a low risk of growing, your healthcare team may decide no treatment is immediately needed. Instead, the use of periodic ultrasounds can help your care team watch the nodule for any change. This is called active surveillance. But you may need surgery to remove part or all of the thyroid if you have a cancerous nodule or a nodule that is suspicious for cancer, or if you have a non-cancerous nodule causing bothersome symptoms like trouble swallowing or breathing, or if you have a nodule that's causing hyperthyroidism and you cannot or prefer not to be treated by other means like antithyroid medication or radioactive iodine. To remove all or part of the thyroid, surgeons usually make an incision, usually about 2 inches long, in the center of the lower neck. This incision is often hidden in the skin crease, making it more discreet. Thyroid surgery can damage nearby structures, resulting in complications like hoarseness or low calcium levels, which may be temporary or permanent. However, certain complications appear to be less common when thyroid removal is performed by an experienced surgeon. Non-prescription pain medication can provide pain relief after surgery. If your entire thyroid is removed, and sometimes if only part is removed, you'll need to take a replacement thyroid hormone for the rest of your life. Most people take synthetic thyroxine, known as levothyroxine. It's often called Levoxyl or Synthroid. Certain people with benign but bothersome thyroid nodules may have an additional treatment known as thermal ablation. Radiofrequency ablation and laser ablation are two common types of thermal ablation. Radiofrequency ablation uses electrical energy and heat to destroy nodule tissue. In this procedure, ultrasound imaging is used to direct a thin needle through the skin into the nodule. The needle delivers high-frequency energy to cause the surrounding tissues to heat up, killing the nearby cells. Radiofrequency ablation typically leaves no scars and can be done in an outpatient setting. It has a faster recovery than thyroid surgery and typically doesn't require taking levothyroxine after the procedure. Rare complications include nerve damage, a temporary hoarse voice, and bleeding at the ablation area. Mayo Clinic researchers are among those exploring whether thermal ablation is an effective way to treat thyroid cancer, especially small cancers limited to the thyroid. Now, here's an interesting article about AI in healthcare. It begins with a chat with a Mayo Clinic expert in AI, Dr. Paul Friedman, who is the chairman of the Department of Cardiovascular Medicine at the Mayo Clinic. Dr. Friedman, how did you get interested in AI and its role in medicine? Our ability to treat cardiovascular disease is truly remarkable. As I progressed in my career, it became increasingly apparent that if we could identify disease earlier, we'd be in a much better position to prevent bad things from happening. The journey of trying to identify disease early by recognizing subtle patterns in biologic information naturally led to the use of AI tools. Can you think of ways that AI is used in medicine already that perhaps people wouldn't realize? AI today is able to read an electrocardiogram, where wires are placed in your chest and a piece of paper records the electrical activity of the heart, to identify conditions that even an expert human cannot identify. What about AI in medicine do you wish people understood better? AI is a tool, and like any tool, it has to be very carefully tested and evaluated so we can be sure that we are properly using it to improve the human condition. What's on the horizon for AI and how it affects healthcare? Generative AI, the kind that can write sentences and process vast amounts of written data, will enable people to review their own charts and ask that the data be explained at an understandable level. This will be in addition to the information gotten from a doctor. It will allow doctors to spend less time at a computer and instead focus entirely on care. The article goes on to say, an age of artificial intelligence influencing medical care and research has arrived. It has brought some changes already, with many more sure to come for years to come and decades to come. You may fear a future involving robot doctors, but a different outcome is more likely. AI has the potential to improve the work of human healthcare teams, making care more personal and effective, according to Mayo Clinic experts. Consider that this new era mostly involves tools that can work behind the scenes to provide results faster, open new treatment options, and possibly improve and prolong lives. AI can shorten the time required to do administrative tasks, loading lab results and visit histories with the push of a button and a quick voice dictation, rather than with hundreds of computer strokes. And AI can sort through massive reams of data with speed and precision, detecting warning signs of disease earlier than previously possible. Taking these tasks off the to-do lists of care teams may leave more time to spend with patients. If done right, AI will bring back more humanity to medicine and help us practice at the top of our ability, says Dr. Paul Friedman. Artificial intelligence refers to the process of training machines of any kind to perform tasks previously only done by people. In short, it imparts the high-level thinking and logic skills of the human mind to a machine or system that lacks such a mind but can be trained in specific tasks. AI has been around since the 1950s and takes many forms across industries. A recent example, Apple Incorporated developed a digital assistant known as Siri who can take instruction from you, either typed or spoken, and perform online tasks like providing driving directions. The use of AI in medicine dramatically expanded in the past two decades, and researchers continue to develop and test new uses of technology. But it also presents new ethical challenges to navigate. For instance, it's important to teach the computer models from data sets that fully represent people of different races, ethnicities, and health circumstances. Often, AI can focus on things that don't require high levels of intelligence, but burden doctors, nurses, and medical administrators. This includes mundane and time-consuming tasks that can easily be performed by a computer, like filling insurance forms or creating schedules. In addition, advances in computing power have made it possible to analyze large amounts of data quickly with consistency and accuracy. This has enabled healthcare scientists to apply AI to huge, complex data sets in a way that improves decision-making, diagnosis, and treatment by detecting patterns in patient data. It's a long process going from research in AI technology to using these tools to treat people. Factors include accuracy and acceptable ethics must be rigorously tested and proved. Here's a small sample of medical conditions already being affected by AI. The first is stroke. A computer trained to analyze CT scans quickly and accurately can cut the time to diagnosis and limit brain damage for people who have a stroke. Then there's heart failure. Applying AI to electrocardiograms has resulted in a low-cost test that can be widely used to detect the presence of a weak heart pump. A weak heart pump can lead to heart failure if left untreated. Then there's atrial fibrillation. AI-guided ECGs also are used to detect faulty heart rhythms, including atrial fibrillation, before symptoms are evident. Colon cancer. AI systems are used to aid medical professionals during a colonoscopy to locate precancerous polyps and allow the doctor to effectively remove them. Pancreatic cancer. AI-guided technology can scan results of CT or MRI exams to distinguish whether suspicious findings are pancreatic cancer or a less severe inflammatory condition like pancreatitis. Finally, there's Barrett's esophagus. AI can now be used to improve accuracy in assessing the results of visual exams of the upper digestive system, called endoscopies. One method is showing more accurate results in diagnosing Barrett's esophagus, an important warning sign of cancer of the esophagus. Now in the section called News and Our Views, in the Mayo Clinic Health Letter. Here's a short article on ovarian cancer vaccine. Cancer of the ovaries represents the most deadly cancer of any reproductive organ. Because of this, researchers have been working to find other treatments, in addition to surgery and chemotherapy, that can improve outcomes. A new vaccine developed by the Mayo Clinic doctors is showing promise. The treatment involves women with advanced ovarian cancer having some of their blood removed by a process called apheresis. White blood cells called monocytes within that blood are engineered in a laboratory to become dendritic cells, cells that can potentially drive new immune responses, including responses against ovarian cancer. Doctors then return these modified cells to the body with the intent to create a specific type of immune response against ovarian cancer known as a Th17 response. This type of response is known to improve the body's immune defense against ovarian cancer. In an initial phase 1 study, researchers treated 18 women with this immune-boosting vaccine. All the women had been diagnosed with ovarian cancer and had undergone initial treatment with surgery and chemotherapy. In 11 participants, the cancer did recur, a common outcome. But 7 of the participants had no recurrence and have remained recurrence-free in the 7 to 9 years since their enrollment in the trial. Typically, 90% of women with ovarian cancer have a recurrence within a decade. In this trial, recurrence was limited to 60%. Because of the promising results, the treatment will now be used in a larger phase 2 trial at all 3 main Mayo Clinic campuses. Now, here's also another interesting short article. In 2020, an estimated 53 million adults in the United States provided unpaid care to another adult. Informal caregiving, common among family members, provides essential assistance for people with health or functional challenges, allowing them to remain at home and to maintain quality of life. But does this effort have negative effects on the caregiver? Some smaller studies have suggested the prolonged stress and physical demands of caregiving are linked to negative effects on both physical and mental health, with an increased risk of premature death. However, a new investigation adds to a growing evidence that women who are caregivers may actually have a lower risk of early death. This new data was featured in the January 2024 issue of the Journal of the American Geriatric Society. It looked at caregiving-related information gathered from over 158,000 postmenopausal women enrolled in the landmark Women's Health Initiative study. At the start of the study, over 40% of these women self-reported as caregivers. During an average follow-up of around 17 years, the rate of death from all causes was 9% lower in caregivers compared with non-caregivers. When broken down into different causes of death, including heart disease and cancer, the mortality rate for caregivers was still significantly lower. This was true even for those who provided care at least 5 times a week, despite the additional stress that such high-frequency caregiving may bring. The reason for these lower death rates is unclear. It may be that healthier people are more likely to become and remain caregivers, and that some of the activities required of caregiving may help to maintain health. Yet the caregiver and non-caregiver study participants reported little difference in their health characteristics, including optimism, depressive symptoms, and general health, and number of health conditions. The interpersonal benefits of caregiving may be another protective factor. Caregiving can instill a sense of usefulness and purpose, and caregivers also may be less likely to be socially isolated. These factors can promote health and longevity. Still, Mayo Clinic experts point out that providing support for caregivers remains an important and often complex issue. Research is ongoing to explore ways to best help caregivers manage their own health and quality of life, especially those with limited supportive resources. Now here's another brief question. My weight has been an ongoing challenge. Now my doctor says I need knee replacement surgery, but first I have to go through a program to get prepared. Research has, the answer, the Mayo Clinic states, research has found that people who are overweight are at a higher risk of complications after knee or hip replacement surgery. Most concerning is an increased risk of infection inside the new joint or at the surgical incision site. Hip and knee prosthesis infections are serious complications that often require additional surgery and removal of the prosthetic joint. People who are overweight also are more likely to need later surgery to address long-term issues like joint loosening or wear and tear. One recent study suggests that a person's weight does not appear to significantly affect the outcome of knee replacement. Some medical centers set restrictions on who is eligible for joint replacement, and most assess on a case-by-case basis. A body mass index of 40 or lower may be required, paired with a commitment to stop smoking. Many centers, including the Mayo Clinic, offer a pre-surgery program focused on weight management and overall health that supports people to have their surgery once important health benchmarks are met. The goals are designed to improve your chances of having successful joint replacement surgery with a lower risk of complications. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.